This is an ABC podcast.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
So most of us have heard of the complex mental health condition schizophrenia. But how many of us understand what it is and what day-to-day life for people living with schizophrenia looks like? Over the past decade or so, we've started talking more openly about mental health conditions like depression and anxiety. But complex mental health conditions like schizophrenia can be left behind. So why is schizophrenia still challenging to talk about? And how much of our limited understanding still comes with stigma, stereotype, and misconceptions? Good morning. My name's Rochelle Hunt, your co-host this morning, Daniel Miles, joining you from ABC Warrnambool. Dan, we received texts and calls from listeners and from loved ones of those who live with schizophrenia over the last week. And it's fair to say that there was a level of frustration around how the media and the wider population often link or refer to mental health conditions as a reason for crime. Mm. And that then fuels stigma. So when it comes to schizophrenia, and this is a reason as to why today's show is happening, it feels like we have so much to learn or to relearn.
Yeah, absolutely. Not only as a media conglomerate, but I think also as individuals. I know, like, I'll put my hand up and say, this is going to be a really enlightening conversation for me, because I think, like a large portion of our audience, I imagine, I know very little about schizophrenia, let alone what it's like to live with such a condition. My only exposure to schizophrenia has been pop culture or schoolyard bullying, and neither of those are in any way helpful. Like you said, most of us don't know what it's like. We know very little about this condition, but I think the one thing we do know, and that we're going to couch this entire conversation with, is that it's a conversation that needs to be had with a lot of respect, because even the word schizophrenia feels like it's a really charged label. It's a charged term. And having something so charged when there's so little known by those who are really throwing this word around probably isn't helpful. One thing I'm really excited about, we've got some really brilliant guests up over this hour, both with lived experience and also experience in the advocacy sector. So we're going to tackle this from all angles and really uncover not only what is it like to actually live with schizophrenia, but where are the gaps in the system where we're falling short?
There's already a text here that says, so are you implying that depression and anxiety are simple mental health conditions? Far from it. I guess what we're saying is we're putting a lot more conversation, resources, focus, treatment, support, research into areas like, and rightly so, into depression and anxiety, because all mental health conditions are complex and are individual. But at the same time, the things like schizophrenia, which can be defined as more complex because there are less resources, because there's potentially less research, because there is potentially less help and assistance, makes it harder for society to discuss and can often make it trickier for individuals who are living with schizophrenia or for their loved ones to know where to go. And as a result, there are holes and there are gaps that people fall through. So today we're going to try and at least just begin the conversation on what schizophrenia looks like. You're going to meet some incredible ambassadors from SANE, people who are living with schizophrenia, loved ones whose parents are living with schizophrenia. And today I would like you to take a little bit of advice from SANE. So we listened in doing research for today. SANE have got an incredible podcast of people who live with different mental health conditions who speak openly about that. And they ask you to take care when you listen to things like we're going to discuss today. So as SANE say, please take care when listening today. But if someone close to you, or maybe it's you yourself, is living with schizophrenia, what would you like us to know and what would you like us to understand?
ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt here with you in Melbourne, your co-host this morning, joining you from ABC Warrnambool, Dan Miles, as we talk about schizophrenia. Cameron Sonnadol is a former board member for SANE and he works in peer support with them still. But Cam is also the host of a podcast called People Like You that is produced by SANE. And Cameron has a lived diagnosis of schizophrenia and has so for over 20 years. Cameron, a warm welcome to the Conversation Hour.
Good morning.
Morning. Now, look, it's fair to say that it has been an incredible, difficult and challenging time for a lot of people over the last week since Bondi. So first question is, how are you?
Look, I'm okay. It's definitely been a challenging week. And if it's been a challenging week for me, who's living with the condition, I can't imagine how difficult the week must have been for everyone who was there. And it's absolutely tragic. And we shouldn't have to keep having these conversations, but we still are. And so we need to push through it from that.
Cameron, can you take us through your story? Because this is something that I think will really be a powerful way for people to learn about schizophrenia. When did you first realise this was a condition that was a part of your life, and how did you go around getting a diagnosis?
Look, I was diagnosed in about 2001, so it's been a long road. But I experienced a severe amount of bullying growing up. There was institutional sexual abuse. There was a result of that. Of course, I turned to drugs, which was not a helpful decision. And as a result, the trauma that I experienced as a child started to present itself in distorted thinking, paranoid thinking, that kind of process. And that hit right in my early 20s, which is quite a stereotypical and very logical place for it to begin. And so as a result of that, my thinking was quite paranoid, quite confused, quite delusional, and honestly quite terrifying. And so as a result of that, I was able to see my GP, who, you know, 20 years ago was able to give me a list of five potential psychiatrists. And 20 years ago, certainly not today, I was able to see the second psychiatrist on the list, I think, that afternoon. So that's very different from today, which could take up to 3 to 6 months just to get that first session with a psychiatrist. So it's been a long journey since then. But when that occurred, the referral came from the GP. He wrote a long letter to the psychiatrist saying, this is what Cameron's experiencing, and can you take it from here? And that's how it began.
Cam, you must feel lucky that you had a GP that was so onto this and that was able to know the sort of help that potentially that you needed and that you had that sort of relationship, because often diagnosis is the trickiest thing to get in the first place, because then from diagnosis then hopefully comes help and assistance and intervention and everything that you may or may not need. But without diagnosis, you're really stuck in limbo land. Was it hard to get that initial diagnosis?
Look, my memory of it is that it wasn't, because when a GP is presented with, you know, certain behaviours and certain thinking and certain sort of red flags, you could say, they instantly know that it's not up to them to provide it, because they can, again, only provide general practitioner, and a professional is the one that's needed. So my GP probably had his own opinions as to what was going on with me, but the fact that he put me straight through to a psychiatrist was it seemed logical at the time for him to do it. So there was no real debate as to whether or not that would be the most logical thing to do. It just seemed like the most down-to-earth thing to do, and so it was subscribing to the medical model right from the beginning.
Cameron, as much as you're feeling comfortable sharing, what was the next steps from there once you met with your psychiatrist and began that treatment?
The first point at which my psychiatrist made a decision was that I had to just stop. What the diagnosis was is that I'd had a psychotic break, so it was a break from reality. I'd had a mental breakdown, and I'd had a nervous breakdown. And this was directly resulted as, this was a direct result of where I was working. Again, a staff member who was particularly powerful in the place I was working had started messing with my life again. And so I became acutely anxious and hyper paranoid that it was all going to begin again, if that gives you any indication. And so while the initial harassment happened, I became so over anxious and so terrified that I started seeing it everywhere. And that's when the delusion and the paranoia stepped in. So that's when the break from reality occurred. So the first thing that my psychiatrist wanted to do was to just calm me down. So I was given medication that would, it was a sedative based medication, not as in an anesthetic, but it was a sedative based medication that just caused me to calm down, and things became a bit blurry for a while, but it was ultimately the decision that I just needed to sleep so I could start making sense again, start reasoning cohesively, and we could start treatment.
How much of schizophrenia as a society do we get wrong? There's already texts coming in from people who are also living with schizophrenia, and everybody's experience in life generally is different, Cameron, right? Then you add the next layer of a mental health condition on top of it. Your response to that and your reaction to that is going to be individual and different as well. Does that make it trickier in terms of getting the tailored help that you need, because your response and your level, so to speak, of schizophrenia will be different to the next person?
Look, there is, in my experience, trauma associated with a psychosis-based diagnosis. I personally have never heard of a person going out one night, having absolutely no issues whatsoever, grown up in a perfectly happy household, smoking one joint, and then all of a sudden developing schizophrenia. That, in my experience, I've never heard of before. So that there is a narrative that is built up to this diagnosis, in my experience. And so trying to navigate that for a person is a complex thing. To give some insight, it took 8 months for the right dose of medication to stabilize me. So we had to try, I think, 2 or 3 different ones, and those take a few weeks to build up in your system to correct the imbalance. But then as a result, it could cause side effects, which you then need to take another medication for. Mm. So it's not a fast process. And so even trying to associate a medical assignment to me, then you have to also slowly start to peel back the layers as to how my head got where it wound up.
Yeah. We're talking with Cameron Soldanol, a former board member of SANE, who works in peer support with that group, and he's also the host of the People Like You podcast. Cameron, we're getting a lot of love for you on the text. Ben from Hampton says, what a brave man, and we absolutely echo that sentiment. One thing that is also coming through is, what do we know about schizophrenia, and what do we get wrong? Generally, as a society, what are we right on and what are we wrong about?
Yeah, there's a text here, Cam, that says, I'm not even sure what schizophrenia actually is.
Yeah. There are a number of psychosis-based illnesses. There is schizophrenia, there is bipolar, there is complex PTSD, where a person is unable to have what is a grasp on reality. And I'm not a doctor, so I'm sure that psychiatrists could give a much better definition for that. But let me tell you what it isn't. It is not dissociative identity disorder. Schizophrenia is not multiple personality disorder. We are not split into 2 people. We are not split into 10 people. It is not dissociative identity disorder. That's one thing that we need to get rid of. I've heard people still relate to which personality are we going to talk to here today. It's not that. Okay, so that's the first thing. And what I need to really express is that a person with a complex mental health issue is far more likely to be a victim of violence than a perpetrator.
Cam, can I ask a question? And I hope this comes out right, but I'm just going to ask it. When we talk about schizophrenia and how that manifests in you, in your life, and when people talk about the voices that they hear, is it always voices? And if they are, because people talk about being able to dial them up or dial them down, and is it your voice that you hear?
Yes, it's not a spiritual voice. It's not a creepy voice. It's not a monstered voice. It's literally my own internal dialogue, and that is the voice that I hear in my head, and that's the voice that we all hear. Unfortunately, my internal dialogue, probably 80% of the time, is working against me.
Yeah.
So it's telling me I'm a terrible person. It's telling me, you know, there's no point getting into all the details. It's basically telling me I'm a terrible person, and that everything I'm doing is wrong. And that's a generalization in specifics, but that's pretty much what you could define my psychosis now as after 20 years. I've never had a visual hallucination, but if I did, I wouldn't be able to tell you if it was real or not, because I've never been able to determine what was real and what wasn't. But I don't believe I've ever had a visual hallucination. But after 20 years, with me being able to understand and harness that, like you mentioned, I can turn it down like a dial. I can just turn it into the background. But matched with that, there is the fact that there are positive symptoms that come from a psychosis, so that I have quite an enhanced creativity. I can associate things together in a creative sense that you wouldn't normally do so. But it's when it takes over your mind and disconnects you from reality is when it becomes an issue. But, you know, that's been over 20 years of living with it. So it's a nuanced thing.
Absolutely. Cameron Solnadol is with you, a former board member for SANE, and is currently working in peer-to-peer support with SANE. You can also hear Cam on the podcast People Like You. You're with Rochelle Hunt and Daniel Miles. This is The Conversation Hour.
On the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt and Daniel Miles with you. I'm in Melbourne. Dan's joining you from ABC Warrnambool. As we're looking at schizophrenia today and just trying to understand more about it, and in particular the stigma and the misconceptions that are wrapped around schizophrenia, Cameron Solnadol is with you, a former board member for SANE and currently working in peer-to-peer support with SANE. Cam, when events like Bondi occur and the sort of language and the sort of, I guess, excuses that are used, how does that impact stigma and misconceptions?
Well, here's something that I only recently thought about. I've actually found myself worried that I'm not allowed to get angry. And it's one of those things where, like, I get angry and I get frustrated with the world, but am I allowed to do that? Or is somebody suddenly think that I'm going to become violent? Because I'm non-violent, but I'm allowed to get angry and frustrated, but I have to worry about that. It's a confusing situation when something like that happens. I mean, look, I was a young, scared kid growing up, but that doesn't translate to the fact that I'm going to be a horrible person when I get older.
There's a text here that says, I've had schizophrenia since I was 9. It doesn't change the underlying personality of who I am. And, I mean, I'm paraphrasing here, but I was talking about that. Don't assume that because you have schizophrenia that you're violent.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know, it's hard enough trying to deal with my own mind. Why on earth would I be sort of considering the idea that I want other people to worry about it? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely it does.
Absolutely. Cameron Solnadol here, former board member of SANE, who works with peer support with that group. Another person with a lot of experience working with SANE is Rachel Green. You're the CEO of SANE, and Rachel joins us on the line now. Good morning, Rachel. Thank you for joining us in what is a nuanced but very important conversation that we're having here. Can you take us through what is actually SANE and what is the work that SANE does?
So SANE's an organisation that's been around for almost 40 years, and we were founded by people with lived experience, mums who had kids living with schizophrenia, people living with schizophrenia. In fact, the name was actually borrowed. We originally founded as the Schizophrenia Fellowship, and the name was borrowed from a UK campaign at the time. SANE was an acronym at that point, and it stood for Schizophrenia, a National Emergency. And it was really created to raise awareness for that and also for other complex mental health conditions and trauma, and the need to reverse the stigma in society and create better options for support. So essentially that's what we do today. We're Australia's national digital mental health support and advocacy organisation.
How far have we come in helping those who are living with schizophrenia and being able to manage the conditions? So there's a text here was talking about a cousin of theirs, and they were placed into a home at 55, they say, because of schizophrenia. And people in the past that I've spoken to are saying that there was this sort of too hard basket, and that people who are living with schizophrenia, and I'm using inverted commas here, would just simply be locked up. How much have we progressed?
Yeah, the answer is it's very, very patchy. So over time, we've gotten better at treatment in many, many ways. We've gotten better at understanding how to combine what we think of as clinical treatments, which would be medications and therapy, with the broader psychosocial supports that make a difference for someone. And that's the kind of support where a person helps you with the activities of day-to-day living. They help you work through the fog, make a plan for how to get dressed every day and manage your own recovery, turn up to appointments, build social relationships. Those sorts of support, psychosocial, when they're delivered, can be incredibly effective. And early comprehensive support where you get all the things, good family support, good clinical support, good early treatment, early in onset, and great psychosocial support, we absolutely believe and we can see that it can change the course of someone's life. The problem is, the comprehensive kind of supports you need, they're expensive to fund. You have to pay the wage of someone who's exceptionally skilled to spend a lot of time with someone, and governments have a habit of turning that on for a bit and turning it off again.
Mm. SANE, of course, has a helpline for anyone that is experiencing any distress or just wants to learn more. That number I'll give you now is 1-800-187-263, 1-800-187-263. Rachel Green, was there a spike in calls to that hotline after the atrocities that we saw in Bondi? Did this raise concerns in the community?
Oh, we've certainly seen an overwhelming amount of activity. In fact, Signal Watch, a program we've been running for close to 30 years, where people can sign up as a volunteer Signal Watcher. They can report media that is unfairly characterising people with complex mental illness. It saw its highest number of reports ever in the 30-year history of the program. And there's discussion on our online 24/7 forums where people are sharing their distress and trauma at what's happened, and also sharing their concerns about what this is going to mean for them and how they might be perceived, similar to what you just heard from Cam. So, yeah, we've absolutely seen a lot of activity following what's happened in the last few weeks.
There's a text here from Lee and it says, I'm a clinical psychologist and I want to thank you so much for this conversation. So much of misunderstanding is in the public space. The big issue is the scant public resources. P.S. Your guest is a legend. I dare say they're referring to you there, Cameron, and calling you a legend. But that idea of help and assistance and information, I have to say, hand on heart, I've had some incredible conversations off air with parents of people who have children who are living with schizophrenia or were living with schizophrenia. And the heartbreak, actually, that you feel from them and that radiates through from them in how to help. And I just sort of wonder, I'm not sure, Cam or Rachel, who can answer this, how much help and assistance there is for family and for loved ones of those who are living with schizophrenia who may be able to help manage, you know, the condition and the symptoms at home or within their own home? How much support there is for parents and for loved ones as well?
Yeah, look, firstly, it is really, really important that there is great support for the family, because the family combined with the GP are the lifelong supports for someone with schizophrenia. And as you've heard from the conversations you've had, often very hard to access that support. In fact, when we first developed our pilot program, the guided service, which we're delivering in about 13 PHN regions around Australia, one of the things we did that was very different was set the eligibility criteria very wide to anyone over 18, including family members and carers, so that they could also receive counselling and support. And most programs don't do that. The old clinical mindset of treat the patient, treat the symptoms, often forgets about the families. And I think one of the things that's really stood out for me in some of the media that I've seen published, even from well-meaning academics and experts and clinicians working in the space, has repeated some of the things that we know family members are told, particularly very early on. They're told, your loved one is never going to have a job, is never going to do well, is going to end up homeless. And they're told this with such certainty, even though we know that, you know, some people have one instance of psychosis and recover fully. According to the World Health Organization, about one in three people with schizophrenia will recover, you know, completely, in the sense that they may not have full absence of symptoms, but like Karen, they'll go on to lead a really meaningful life,
yeah.
Be a director on the board, be a dad, get married. But families are still told that it's the end of the world, and that makes it extra difficult for them to feel like there's hope, to tell their friends, to tell their workplace what's going on. I mean, there's a lot of talk about workplace mental health at the moment, and a group that's often forgot are the needs of carers. And
do many people disclose?
For reasonable adjustment.
Cam, have you ever disclosed, or did you, maybe you do now, but in the early days, did you disclose schizophrenia to workplaces?
Just to preface that, I was back at work within 18 months, if that gives any indication. So we were able to, fortunately, be able to get some therapy. But, you know, again, $400 an hour is incredibly expensive. But I was able to get back to work within 18 months. But this was, you know, 2000, 2003 or so. I certainly did not disclose that I had schizophrenia at all. We were barely talking about anxiety and depression back in the back at the start of the millennium. So there was no way I was going to throw schizophrenia into the mix. Today, I can't really hide from it. So there's absolutely no issue about disclosure now. But back then, I absolutely would not have disclosed. But we have lead characters in TV series who have bipolar. We have the number one British music artist was talking about it. His guy called Ren, who was talking about his journey with psychosis. I see any kid between the age of 20 and 30 having irregular or regular sessions with a psychologist, or just talking to their friends about their mental health. So I don't see it as that much of a stretch when someone has to move into the realm of complex mental health recovery nowadays.
So much of it is about breaking that stigma and getting that education out there in the first place. But I guess the second part of that, Rachel Green, is having the support. We're absolutely blessed, and we know, Cameron, you were really fortunate, you said yourself, to be able to get in from a GP to a psychiatrist within the same afternoon. But we know that that can't be the ultimate case anymore. We're seeing wait lists and the like really stretching out, which can cause distress. So in that sense, Rachel, what do we need to do to improve access so that we don't have people falling through the gaps, so that the ultimate and best level of care is out there for anyone who is struggling with such conditions?
Well, this is the million-dollar question. I think in our view, for people with complex mental health needs, they need some sort of guarantee at the first step. So when they go and see their GP, they and the GP need an ability to prioritise a comprehensive package of support for people. And similar packages exist in other areas of disease and illness where, you know, if you've got a certain type of condition, you can be provided with a package of support from different people. And we need the same thing for complex mental illness. It should include more sessions under better access. It should include access to services like ours that provide counselling, psychosocial support and coordination. That coordination element is critical. And for any listeners, if complex mental illness seems a bit foreign, if you think too, if you've ever had to coordinate, I don't know, aged care, it's the same sort of challenge of trying to negotiate with multiple different parts of the health system. And then if you put on top of that, you know, you're on a low income, or you're in a regional area, or you just can't find a specialist who, you know, doesn't send you away because you're actually too complex. We hear that a lot from people. So what it takes is the kind of minimum guarantee accessibility, and to make that available in all around the country, then telehealth and digital's got to be part of the solution. But it needs to be funded at the level it takes. And I'll come back to that just for a moment, if you'll let me, because you know, we've had programs in the past, national psychosocial programs, that provide an intensive level of support, and they were all rolled into the NDIS. And now there's a lot of concern about what's happening in the NDIS and where complex mental illness is going to end up. Victoria is a state in particular that threw a lot of its programs in, and, you know, as a result, not too long after that, we've ended up with a Royal Commission to try and untangle things. So it's time to stop the patchiness and invest properly.
How tricky I mean, when we talk about trying to navigate things, let's throw the NDIS into this conversation. But I know there was a woman who is living with schizophrenia called Raphael Epstein on our mornings program here in Melbourne and spoke about how difficult it was for her to be able to access NDIS with schizophrenia. Now, because that's really broad, right? You can't just say with schizophrenia because, Cam, as you've been saying, it's individual and there's sliding scales of how it manifests in your body and how it impacts and affects your life and maybe what other underlying conditions you and experiences you may have. But broadly speaking, Rachel, is there support there through NDIS for people who are living with schizophrenia?
Well, look, first of all, the NDIS access to it isn't based on a diagnosis. It's based on this concept of psychosocial disability, and it's the one place where the NDIS functions pretty well backwards. So if you acquire a disability or you have a disability from birth, your eligibility is not in question. When it comes to psychosocial disability, having a diagnosis of schizophrenia isn't enough. You actually have to progress far enough and your mental health has to deteriorate far enough that it can be determined that no more help is likely to change things. And the process of that is devastating for people, especially when they go through it or when they actually get knocked back and told, no, it's not permanent. Treatment hasn't failed enough for you yet. That's the actual process that people go through. And so in a practical sense, it means that if you've got a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, 17-year-old starting to go off the rails, something's a bit strange, and you aren't able to access great early psychosis treatment, and you aren't able to access great family care, you'll keep trying to access the NDIS and watch the years go by and the teeth fall out and the relationships disintegrate. And I don't mean to be overly graphic here, but the process tells you, try again, come back later when things are a little bit worse. And it's the opposite of everything we've ever tried to do in recovery.
Especially in particular with something like schizophrenia. Oh, yes. My goodness.
And the medications that are prescribed, often I've sat down with, pharmacy companies who will often sort of donate to our work because, you know, they want to help challenge stigma as well. I've sat down with them and they said, you know, these medications can be really effective, but long-term use can have, you know, problematic side effects. They'd rather see people getting better and more well and recovering earlier. But that's not what the system's designed to do. It's the opposite of the way we treat cancer, where we go in, we go hard, we go early, with the exception of a few cancers, and we throw everything at it. We do not do that with complex mental illness in Australia.
Rachel, thank you so much for your work and the advocacy that you do and that the entire organisation at SANE does. We know that your website, you host online forums for people who are living with schizophrenia and for carers, for parents as well, because as I have said multiple times, there are a lot of siblings and there are a lot of parents who are texting us and calling us. It's just taking us some time to read through them because a lot of the times people don't want to be identified and we don't want to start to read something out and then realise that somebody doesn't want their details read out. But you've got some incredible resources there on the SANE website. Rachel, thanks for taking time out to speak with us today. Rachel Green, the CEO of SANE.
Yeah. Rich, some really heartfelt text messages coming through on this line. This one here, my brother suffered with years with schizophrenia. It broke our heart watching what he went through. He was living, he was not violent, yet he was still judged. Unfortunately, he passed away at age 40, 20 years ago. He was on so much medication, it damaged his heart and life was a struggle. My mum was by his side every step of the way. That's from Karen in Preston. Thank you for sharing that. But then this as well. As a now retired psychiatrist who worked both in the public and private sectors, I can say that while there were some good results and momentums and moments of encouragement overall, the lack of resources available leading to frequent inability to implement the variety of treatments and supports one had been trained to provide was often deeply discouraging. I salute all those clinicians at the coalface in 2024. A varied discussion here, Rish, that there's so much still to unpack for us.
Absolutely. Well, the SANE's phone number, if you need it, it's 1800 187 263. That could be for you or maybe, you know, as a carer, as a parent, as a sibling, you want to speak to someone, or if you are someone that is living with schizophrenia, you can also go to their website and maybe you can get some more information about one of the next forums that they've got coming up. You're on the Conversation Hour today as we just try and unpack a little bit about what living with schizophrenia looks like, what the realities are and what the misconceptions are.
on the ABC Listen app, your smart speaker, and on AM radio.
This is The Conversation Hour on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, Rochelle Hunt and Daniel Miles with you. And joining you this hour as well, Cameron Sonladol, who is a former board member with SANE, currently working in their peer-to-peer support team. And Cam is also the host of People Like You podcast, which is an incredible podcast that is produced by SANE. Cameron, you've been, for people who have just joined us, you've been speaking very openly about your diagnosis of schizophrenia, which you've had for over 20 years. There's quite a few messages that have come through, and I'm going to kind of paraphrase a few of them, but they've come through from loved ones of people who are living with schizophrenia, talking about the fact that the person didn't believe that they had schizophrenia, that they honestly just didn't think that they had it or didn't want to believe that they had it, and as a result either self-medicated with drugs like marijuana or they refused to take their medication. Is that something that you've experienced, that you've spoken to other peers about?
Here's the thing. Look, there was no history of mental illness in our family. So I knew something was wrong, but I had no idea that it was going to be something like schizophrenia. So if you have people who are trying to accept their diagnosis, it, due to the understanding of what I had growing up, you know, it was a very stereotypical understanding of schizophrenia, that, you know, it's something that is difficult to accept, and it took a lot of confusion, a lot of working through to understand that this is what schizophrenia is. But within 3 to 4 years, everything that I knew about schizophrenia was completely wrong.
Yeah.
So
you were even judging yourself and your own initial diagnosis.
Absolutely. And I had in my head, and you know, and everyone in their head who would be terrified of a diagnosis of schizophrenia has those images and those stereotypes that they've grown up with, or hopefully as a younger generation haven't grown up with, because there's so much, such a better understanding. Mm. And the difficulty and the one thing that I need to get across is I firmly subscribe to the medical model of medication. And the reason being is that there is a confusion out there in the state of medication. There is a difference between medication that will make you feel better and medication that will help you get better. If you've got a broken arm, you take some Panadol and Nurofen to ease the pain. That makes you feel better, but that does not heal your broken arm. So when you have something like schizophrenia, the medication needs to build up in your system. The actual chemicals need to build up in your system to help. And that is where it is. That is where I find that it is imperative that you stick with the medication and that you trust the medical model with that. And that's just been my experience for 20 years. I've been on the same dose of medication now. I think the only thing that I removed was an antidepressant, maybe about 10 or 11 years ago. But I've been pretty much on the same medication for the past 15, 20 years.
If you're just tuning in and that voice is familiar, it's Cameron Sonladol, and he might be familiar to you as the host of the People Like You podcast, which is a brilliant listen if you get a chance. One episode that I know Rish and I both listened to, Cam, was your chat with Elfie Scott. Elfie's a SANE ambassador, a journalist, an author of The One Thing We Have Never Spoken About, Exposing Our Untold Mental Health Crisis. And Elfie joins us on the Conversation Hour now as well. Good morning to you, Elfie. One thing I'd love to touch on with you is your experience as someone who's lived with a loved one that's gone through schizophrenia. And this is something we're getting a lot on the text line, is that idea of looking out for those that are looking out for people with schizophrenia. Can you take us through your story, how you navigated such a tricky thing in life and what you've learned from it?
Hi, yeah. Thank you so much for having me, and lovely to hear from you again, Cam. So I grew up with a mum who has schizophrenia, and, you know, it was quite an interesting experience as a teenager, just because I was, you know, so exposed to the symptoms of schizophrenia, but we never actually spoke about it. So that's why my book is titled that. It was sort of the one topic that we never broached. It was an open secret in our family. And it just felt so heavily stigmatized to the point that we could never talk about it openly. And I didn't speak about it openly with, you know, friends or anybody outside of my household or inside my household for years and years.
Did you know that your mum had schizophrenia, Elfie? Did you speak about it so little that you didn't even know what her diagnosis was?
Yeah, so I actually didn't even know the term schizophrenia until I was about 14. I think that, you know, there were obvious signs that something was wrong or different within our household, but it was just never something that I was taught about. And I eventually just had to do a lot of my own research, which I think is what led me to trying to understand more about people who live with schizophrenia, as well as, you know, educating myself throughout university about psychosis and other complex mental health conditions.
Elfie, how have you seen the media's portrayal over the last week, fortnight, since the Bondi attacks? You're a journalist, you're an author yourself, you understand the ways that we can talk about this, but what have you made about the portrayal throughout the media and the way that that's been handled over the last couple of days particularly?
Yeah, I mean, it's been really distressing. And as soon as I saw that news emerge about the attacker's mental health condition, I mean, I started getting really upsetting messages from people who I'd spoken to before, as well as, you know, strangers who just wanted to reach out to me because they'd read the book and they have loved ones with schizophrenia, or they themselves had schizophrenia. You know, I think there was a huge amount of concern about the media portrayal of that story, particularly in terms of the way that schizophrenia was pointed to as a sole causation of what happened. And you know, when it comes to journalistic ethics around the reporting of complex mental health conditions, there were a few outlets who, yeah, slipped up and posted things that were deeply stigmatizing and really worrying in terms of how they just drew a direct line between schizophrenia and this extremely violent incident.
How much does that tell us about society in terms of how little we understand about schizophrenia, and how much our image is drawn from popular culture, is drawn from falsity? You know, the idea that schizophrenia is largely connected to violence in some way, or really outward, you know, erratic behaviour. I mean, the picture is so big there in terms of how we need to relook at it. I mean, we've come a long way with mental health and discussing it, but schizophrenia, it feels like there's still so much work that needs to be done.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I don't know about you, but I remember when I was growing up, there was a spate of horror movies that came out that, you know, portrayed killers as having schizophrenia or dissociative identity disorder, split personality syndrome. And those two conditions were kind of conflated, and schizophrenia was presented as something that was, you know, inherently evil, and anybody who had it was at risk of doing incredibly violent things. So I think we've been primed by entertainment, we've been primed by the media to believe that there is this deep fundamental connection between violence and schizophrenia. And while, you know, psychosis can be a contributing factor to violence, it's also worth pointing out that it is much more complicated and nuanced than simply saying that people who have complex mental health conditions are violent.
And we've got this on the text line from Yvonne in Richmond: referring to people with schizophrenia rather than schizophrenics would help start to reduce that stigma. People are much more than a diagnosis, which I think is a really salient point. But, you know, journalistically, how do we improve? How do we do this in a proper and safe way, Elfie?
Well, I think when it comes to incidents like what happened in Bondi Junction, we have to accept that it's going to take time to undertake that investigation. And, you know, I think that we jump to conclusions just because we're trying to put the pieces of that puzzle together. But I think we have to be more tolerant of the idea that these investigations take weeks and months to piece together. And we're not probably going to get clear answers in the end anyway. So I think we have to be comfortable with this kind of ambiguity and, you know, a lack of clear answers. But then I also think that, you know, journalists have a strong responsibility here to use correct language, as in, you know, avoiding things like saying schizophrenic person, only using mental health conditions when they're genuinely relevant, and also including nuance and detail about people's lives.
Absolutely. I mean, we know as journalists, and now there's been a change in ensuring that relating something to a terror attack, you can't just go out and say that now. You have to make sure, and you need to do all your checks and balances. If you applied that same kind of rhetoric when it came to a mental health condition and ensuring that you can't just go throwing things around until, you know, you have really researched and figured out whether or not it is even vaguely relevant. Elfie, you spoke about having to go and do your own research to try and understand your own mum's schizophrenia to the point where you completed a psychology degree in an effort to try and understand it. So that is taking it to the
next level.
That's good research. That's doing your background checks.
Yep.
But where are we at? I mean, if you were 14-year-old Elfie now, would that information be there for you? Has it got better? Have resources got better?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what Cam was saying earlier about sort of younger generations having access and being more open to talking about mental health conditions in general. I would say that there are a lot of, I mean, I use the word influencers loosely. I don't know whether they would call themselves influencers, but there are people out there who are on TikTok and Instagram who are sharing this kind of information and making it more accessible to younger people, which is really joyous to see. But I would also add, in terms of the media coverage, I would love to see journalists covering more positive stories about people who live with schizophrenia and other complex mental health conditions. Like, I think that's the other side of the coin that we're not really tapping into yet.
Elfie, thanks so much for your time. Elfie Scott is a SANE ambassador, journalist and author of The One Thing We Have Never Spoken About, Exposing Our Untold Mental Health Crisis. We're talking about schizophrenia today, and on top of it, also access to treatment and information. Dr. Simon Strafici is the chair of the Victorian branch for the College of Psychiatrists. Simon, a warm welcome back to the Conversation Hour. At the beginning of the program, Cameron, who is still with us, spoke about how easy it was for him to access a psychiatrist. We know that there are long waiting lists at the moment. On one hand, I guess that's a good thing in more people are reaching out and knowing that they need help. Are you frustrated as a professional in terms of the waiting lists or the help that is or isn't available to those who may be living with or in need of a diagnosis of schizophrenia?
Hi, Rochelle and Daniel. Thanks for having me on today. And thank you to everybody who's been contributing to this conversation. It's wonderful to listen in and to join in, you know, in this really important discussion. Yes, I am frustrated. I think many of us are. We know that that about over a quarter of people who need to see a psychiatrist experience significant delays or actually don't see one due to cost, and this proportion is actually increasing. We know that we're well short of psychiatrists across the country, and the National Mental Health Services Planning Framework sets a target, and it appears that we're at least a couple of thousand full-time equivalents short in terms of psychiatrists. So there's a real problem in this regard.
How do we breach that gap? We know that treatment like this is expensive, but that's, I think, probably in part due to the fact that it is such a specialised area and there's a high level of skill that goes into treating these conditions. How do we breach the gap between those who can afford and can't afford this treatment and also that wait that people are going through at the moment?
Look, we do hear a lot of people giving feedback that care is too expensive, and expense should never be a barrier to receiving treatment, care and support when it's needed in this country. I think that, you know, the solutions that the College of Psychiatrists is really keen on pursuing is to radically increase the number of psychiatrists that are available, and indeed increase the number of all clinical groups, psychologists, mental health nurses, mental health social workers and so on, and other allied health practitioners. We know here in Victoria that we had a Royal Commission which said that the system was broken, that pointed out to major shortcomings within the system, and one of the most significant shortcomings was the lack of investment in workforce. Now, we've seen a turnaround, but it's, you know, it's going to take more than 2 or 3 years to fix the results of really 2 or 3 decades of neglect.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it does seem like there has been progression. It's easy to look at this and feel really depressed about how much work needs to be done. But there's one text here and it says, this is a great conversation. My darling and maternal Nana developed a form of schizophrenia and manic depressive illness, now known as bipolar. It was back in 1934 and she was placed into what was then called a mental asylum in regional Victoria for 26 years. Lithium and shock treatment was a part of her treatment. It was a hidden secret. My gramps raised my mum and her sister, and in 1960, when I was age 16, my dear Nana was discharged and she came to live with us. I'm almost 80 now and I've worked within the mental health field as well. So we have come a long way. Just finally, would you like, Simon, to see better support from the government, at least in terms of, you know, rebates and being able to go and sit down with a psychiatrist or a psychologist to be able to have that funding there?
The answer is yes, perhaps predictably, but I would make the point that we need much more than that. And I think some of the other speakers have pointed to the consequences of complex mental illnesses. We need services, and the Royal Commission highlighted this, and we've seen some progress here in Victoria, but there's a need right across the country to improve access to housing, which is really problematic. We need to address sources of poverty, unemployment, social isolation, loneliness. There are consequences to experiencing complex mental illnesses that are really much broader than the clinical consequences. So yes, good comprehensive clinical services are required, but we need so much more.
It's a multifaceted conversation and one that we won't stop having. Dr. Simon Strafacci, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And of course, Cameron Soldanol, you've been with us throughout this hour. It's been illuminating for me. I've learned so much. But if we were to be able to give people at home who are listening in or listening into this as a podcast one little nugget of inspiration, what's the one thing you want people to take away from this discussion?
Look, the number one thing that I've been thinking about with this is that if anyone has received a diagnosis, you can still be the person you are or want to be. It's a diversion. It just may take a little longer than planned.
Yeah, well, there's a text here that says, thank you. Thank you for the insight and for dispelling some of those myths. Cam, we say thank you as well. People can listen to your podcast. It's produced by Sane. It's called People Like You. People can also go to Sane's website. They can become a part of the forums to get information. They can also give them a buzz. The number's 1-800-187-263. Cameron, thank you so much for your time today, mate. We might get you back another time because I think this is part one of this conversation. Good on you.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks so much.
Good on you. Don't forget the number for Sane is 1-800-187-263. If we didn't read out your text today, we're going to stay back. We're going to read through them all. But as you can understand, they were long and they were complicated and they were emotional. We want to make sure that we're doing the right thing by you. But thank you so much for your text. Don't forget the Conversation Hour is also a podcast. This show in particular, if you want to listen back, go to the ABC Listen app. Take care. Speak tomorrow.